listening to the A Minute to Midnight show. This is Tony, and today the guest on the show is a returning Norm Franz. And we had Norm on a few weeks ago, and it was a great show, and I had quite a bit of feedback from people with questions for me to ask Norm in the next show. We welcome Pastor Norm Franz back to the A Minute to Midnight show. And once again, Norm, I've been really looking forward to this discussion. And I know other members of the A Minute to Midnight team were quite excited to have you coming back. So they had questions that they wanted to ask you as well. So thank you for coming back on today.
Well, it's my pleasure, Tony. Time went so fast last time. And I felt like we hadn't really completed everything, so I'm glad that you contacted me back so we can put a capstone on this thing.
Absolutely. I had the same feeling. So, yes. Well, probably the first place I'd like to start is the move towards a cashless society. What's happening there, and what's the purpose in the way that you see things?
Well, this goes back to the Hegelian dialectic that I talk about in the book Money and Wealth in the New Millennium, and that basically operates according to the ancient philosophy of ordo ab chao, order out of chaos. And Professor Friedrich Hegel taught this in German universities prior to World War I. And it just basically theorizes that you have thesis and then you have antithesis. And when those two forces come together, it produces synthesis or the desired outcome. In other words, crisis brings change and controlled crisis brings controlled change. And what we're seeing in the earth right now being initiated by globalism is the continued crisis that we have in so many areas among the nations, from everything from the financial system to tax evasion to terrorism to the black market, so on and so forth. There is just a widespread corruption, and then also the ability to pay for things in cash. We have to understand that terrorists don't finance their bombs using, Visa or MasterCard or loans from, Chase Manhattan or anything like that. It's all done in cash. And so they're going after the cash. They're trying to get the cash out of the system so that we can move toward more of a digital system so that they can control and track the economic and social behavior of the nations, of the peoples of the world. And we're seeing this, and this is really important because, there's a biblical principle, Ecclesiastes 10 and verse 19 says, "Men prepare a meal for enjoyment, and wine makes life merry, and money is the answer to everything." And so in the end, whoever controls the money in every aspect of it ultimately controls the nations and the people of those nations. And so they're coming after the cash. We just finished a series here at Ascension Ministries on our broadcast. In fact, if your listeners want to go to our website at ascensionministries.net, they can go to our YouTube site and pull that up and watch that series on a look at the 2017 through 2014. We talk about what's coming. It's a prophetic look at that period of time because we believe it's really significant. And the thing that we focused primarily on was war. Prepare for war, and the war on cash was one of those things that we talked about in there. And so And so what we're doing, what we're seeing is governments around the world now are starting to put limitations on cash, whether it be eliminating certain notes. For example, the European Union recently discontinued the 500 euro note. That'd be like, we used to have a $10,000 note in the States. Then it went down to 1,000, then they eliminated that. And then we had our 500, they eliminated that. And we're at 100 now. In fact, there are globalists like Larry Summers, a former Treasury Secretary, who is actually advocating that we do away with the $100 bill, because so much illegal drugs and even in the Middle East they use the U.S. dollar because of its strength. Another thing we're seeing that France has just lowered the cash transaction limit from 3,000 euros to 1,000 euros. In other words, anything over and above $1,000 is not allowed within that banking system. Individuals can make transactions, but so you can't go into a store or any place like a retail store and buy something for more than $1,000 in cash. Anything over and above that, you'd have to use some electronic funds, like, you know, debit cards and things on that order. Spain has banned cash transactions above $2,500. Italy has banned cash transactions above 1,000 euros. And so this is happening all around Europe. And part of the reason that, for example, Italy is doing that is because of the financial crisis that's in Italy. And they don't want cash leaving the country. If they ban the $1,000 transactions, then what happens is any movement of cash has to be done through electronic fund transfer that they can track and watch and see. And so, again, that goes back to ultimately control. Whoever controls the money controls the people and the nation. And here's a big one now. On November 8, 2016, India demonetized the $500 banknote and the $1,000 banknote. And now they've done this before, because some people say, well, heck.
It wasn't dollars, though, was it? Rupees.
No, rupees. Yeah. That's right. That would be like the $500 banknote, as far as the rupee goes, would be like $7.40 U.S. And the $1,000 banknote would be like $15 U.S. So they banned those banknotes. And yes, they've done that in the past. The only problem was they did not replace that. And people were out in the streets protesting, saying, what's going on? Why no replacement for those bank drafts and things on that order? So anything above like $7.40 has to be done through electronic fund transfer in India now. And so, I mean, these are just some examples of what we're seeing right now. And here's the aspect of what the globalists are saying, or what governments are saying, is that the government said, when people asked, you know, and they only had in India, they only had 4 hours to turn their paper money in. That was it. After that, you couldn't turn it in. So a lot of people lost a lot of money, and you didn't hear much about that in the news, but it was big news in India. And so what we saw was that the government, and here's what the government said when the people rose up, they said the government said the action would curtail the shadow economy that uses illicit and counterfeit cash to fund illegal activity and terrorism, because they don't want any more terrorism in their country. And again, there was a conference that just took place. And out of that conference came the edict from a Nobel laureate, a former economist. And he basically said, that countries like the United States should ban the use of cash and go strictly to electronic fund transfer. That would do away with any tax evasion. That would do away with funding terrorism. That would do away with funding illicit drugs and so on and so forth. And so, of course, they're legalizing drug here in the States. So, you know, it probably won't be too long before that's, you know, everything's legal. And so for all of those reasons, the crises is the illicit drugs, the tax evasion, terrorism, and the financing that cash does. The solution to that, that's the thesis, the antithesis or the solution to that is a closed cashless society, and the synthesis or the desired outcome is the economic and social control of the economic and social behavior of everyone. That's how the Hegelian dialectic is working in this whole war on cash to get us to an EFT. And the last thing is that one of the reasoning is that only about 7% of all transactions are actually done with cash now. Everybody's using, here in the States, I don't know what it's like down in New Zealand, I'm assuming it's the same. You now have your debit cards and your credit cards that have the chip.
Yeah, very little cash, I think, now compared to what it was certainly here in New Zealand. Just going back to India, though, I see I watched a short video the other day where someone was advocating, who was a part of the system in India, and the whole biometric identification, and they have so big a percentage of the population of India now with biometric identification that they can actually do transactions without even needing a card. They're bypassing cards entirely, and you know they can do it from their cell phone or whatever. And it's like, I'm thinking, if they can do that in India, then India could be like a test case for the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and usually it's your lesser developed countries that, you know, give way to that first. Here in America, I mean, you know, we're used to having our cash. We like our mattress money. We don't trust the banks necessarily. A lot of people have pulled cash out of the bank and they just keep it in a safe. And really the problem with that is that if they outlaw cash, if there's a crisis in this country, I mean, like some sort of a weapon of mass destruction, God forbid, in the United States, I'm just going to use the U.S. as an example, or any country, they could come out and say, you know, you've got 4 hours to turn your cash in because this attack was financed with cash, we've traced it, and so we're going to an EFT type of system. And most people, depending on how serious the attack was, a terrorist attack was, most people would say, yeah, let's do it. Let's get rid of this stuff. We can't have any more of this. So the crisis creates an atmosphere by which a solution is automatic. The people will say, yes, let's do it. Now, there's going to be some holdouts that, you know, say no. Although, you know, Tony, what I do when I go into a store and I use my debit card with the chip, I'll say things like, ah, yes, the chip. Yes, you know that one of these days the book of Revelation says that chip is going to be in your hand or on your forehead. And some of the tellers, some of the, you know, people waiting on you there at the cash register, some of them just roll their eyes and go, yeah, another religious nut. But this one gal up at the grocery store here close to us, she looked around to make sure nobody was listening. And she looked at me and she says, yeah, I know. You know, and so I use it as an opportunity to witness about God's word, the Bible, because everything that we have need of to understand the last days and how to prepare for it and what to do, just like we prayed before we started to record, Lord, let us be like the sons of Issachar who understood the times and knew what to do. God's word not only reveals what's going on, what his plan is around that whole thing, but what to do in light of that in the times that we're in. And that's one of the reasons why I love him so much, is because he hasn't left us without understanding or direction.
Yes, that's true. So with what's going on in the financial world, Chris asked me a couple of questions to pass on. That's Chris from our team. He sort of said, so what's the reflationary environment that some pundits are talking about? And also, if there's hyperinflation, what can society expect to see?
Well, you know, in the past, we've looked in at there being inflation going on. But the problem, and your inflation is primarily in the paper assets, investment assets. You know, Wall Street right now is wildly inflated and getting worse. I mean, it's going up like crazy, and we can talk about why that is in a minute. But part of it is because people are taking money and not just taking money and investing in stocks and well, bonds not so much. People have kind of gotten out of bonds because interest rates are going up, which kind of take where bonds take a hit. But they're going into the stock market, and we have to understand that when you take X amount of dollars, a lot of money, and you put it into anything, whether it's the economy, like real estate or just consumer goods or whatever. That raises the prices. It doesn't raise the value, but it artificially raises the prices. That's the definition of inflation, is the increase in the amount of money or credit in a system that results in a money's sudden drop in value and a rise in prices. So the inflation right now is happening on Wall Street. Because not only are they putting money into it, but they're borrowing money to buy stock, which drives it farther or drives it higher faster. In the economy, however, we don't have that phenomenon. And part of the reason was supply economics, which was supply-side economics, where they just kept the supply of goods and services high. Because inflation is usually too much money chasing too few goods is another definition of it. But if you have plenty of product, then you can keep the prices down. Plus, globalism moved our services and our manufacturing offshore to where they could be produced for less money. So when they got shipped back in here, they cost less money. And with a stronger dollar, which is what we have, because so many people are bringing money to the United States, I mean, there's really no place else left to invest in the world. I mean, I'm not going to invest in Europe with everything that's going on over there, or Russia. You know, after Perestroika, people started investing in Russia. And it's like, man, I'm not investing in Russia now. Nobody is. They're pulling their money out. Same thing with India. I mean, it's just like... It's like there's this move in the Middle East. It's like there's move of money out of those countries and going to the place that's the safest right now, and that's the United States of America. And so all that money coming in here is keeping our dollar strong, which is keeping inflation down. So there's a number of reasons why you're not seeing the inflation, and you're not going to see that for a while. In the economy, you're going to see inflation in paper investments as people bring their money over here and invest it in dollar-denominated assets. But you're not going to see it. You're going to see some now. It's going to start picking up here a little bit. But you're not going to see a hyperinflation anytime soon. The only way that hyperinflation would take place is if the dollar collapsed. And right now, the only way the dollar could really collapse is if America defaulted on its debt, which isn't going to happen anytime immediate.
Okay, so, what investments are to be avoided and what are to be embraced, particularly if there's any sort of major economic calamity on the way?
Well, you know, one of the things that I do in the book and in the seminars and the various teachings that I do, especially when I'm dealing with the economy, is I help people understand what happens when certain things take place in the financial system and how it affects the economy and so on and so forth. For example, the over there in your neck of the woods, up in Southeast Asia in 97, when you had the devaluation of the Thailand baht, you had guys like George Soros who had been buying the baht long. In other words, he was borrowing money to buy the baht. That forced the baht artificially high. But then what he did was he dumped all of his currencies, all of the Thailand baht, and got out and took a huge profit. But the baht collapsed, and so did the Malaysian ringgit and the Indonesian currency, and on and on and on. And in the book, Money and Wealth in the New Millennium, I show a graph of what happened to the price or the value of the Malaysian ringgit and how it collapsed. I mean, you can see this graph come down. But what I did was I laid the price of gold over the collapse of the ringgit, the price of gold in ringgits, and gold went up at the same level that the ringgit came down. Gold went up. In the United States, gold pretty much just stayed the same. So what happened? Did gold actually go up? The answer is no. The ringgit, the value and the purchasing power of the ringgit went down so that it took more ringgits to buy the same amount of gold. And so if there is some sort of a collapse of a currency where the value, the artificial, and the U.S. dollar is really strong right now, and a good part of that is artificial. If there's some sort of sell-off in the U.S. dollar for whatever reason, gold prices will spike, not because gold is necessarily worth more, but because the paper money is worth less.
So would you suggest that there is going to be some sort of a financial calamity, or is it going to affect other parts of the world before it would affect America?
Well, I think America is probably going to be the last thing to go and the last country to go. And the reason that is, I believe, is because America has the biggest printing press in the Federal Reserve. You know, it's like in 07 when we had this last, you know, collapse here. That shotgunned around the world and affected everybody, and that's because in large part everybody was invested in U.S. dollar denominated assets, you know, the various subprime mortgages. People had bought those. Iceland bought a bunch of those and put it into their as a place of investment for their country's wealth, and Iceland went broke. I mean, they just had to, you know, bow down to the New World Order and say, you know, they came to them with hat in hand and said, whatever you want. And they are owned now by the New World Order globalists and the bankers, the international banksters. And so I think as things unfold, if the United States actually collapses, the whole world will collapse. But also, right now, I think we talked about it last week, we have, just in the United States, we have $600 trillion of bank derivatives. If the market moves against those and they start to collapse, it's over for the whole world. But Japan has about $350 trillion of bank derivatives. And if that goes, you're probably going to see a chain reaction that might bring down the whole world system. But at some point in time, Tony, this debt bubble and the global debt bubble right now is about $1.5 quadrillion. If we have a chain reaction where most of that debt, which is just being created out of nothing as money in the form of loans in banks someplace, the whole world's financial system would collapse.
So,
and at that particular, go ahead.
So I was going to say, well, I think a lot of people probably don't understand even what derivatives are. We hear that word, but people kind of go, "What are they?" And the second thing is, then If someone is in debt when the financial crisis hit, what's going to happen to the debt and the debtor?
Well, you know, we've had, if you look at what happened to in 07 here in the United States, the various companies that were in debt that had to be bailed out, like some of the automobile companies here in the United States, the government, whoever comes in to bail them out, is going to take equity in the company, is going to take the company as collateral. That's the whole issue. I know that, and most people don't realize that. And this is just an accounting thing that's my background is in the area of accounting and economics and stuff. And we have to understand that there's an end time transfer of wealth that comes during this crisis. And people who are in debt, when they can't pay their debt, then whatever's up for collateral now is collected on by the lender. And so when the United States went in and bailed out the car companies, the United States government went in and took possession of stock in those companies and became an owner of it. In other words, the value and the wealth and the actual ownership of those privately owned and funded car companies, a good portion of it was transferred to the United States of America as the lender, as collateral to the lender for the loan, for the bailout. And that's how the whole world financial system is going to be transferred over to total control of the bankers, is that when it collapses, the bankers are going to confiscate the entire world. And I believe that all your central banks and all of that are going to go down in the midst of this whole thing as well. And so that's what I talk about in the book when I talk about the debt for equity swaps. Because you see, there's a debt for equity swap that's coming on a global scale. Is that when this thing collapses, what's going to happen is that you're going to have a new financial banking system rise up out of the ashes. In fact, the United Nations predicted this back in the 90s in their human development report. Here's what the Nobel laureate, the economist Jan Tinbergen says. He says this in this report from the UN. He said, "Mankind's problem can no longer be solved by national governments. What is needed is a world government. This can best be achieved by strengthening the United Nations system. Some of the most important UN institutions would be financial, a world treasury, and a world central bank. The world treasury would serve as the world ministry of finance. Its main task would be to collect the resources needed by the other world ministries through one or more systems of global automatic taxations. In addition, there would be a world central bank based on a reformed IMF to deal among other things with monetary banking and exchange policies." And then it goes on and it says that there would have to be some sort of global economic crisis before a world central bank could come along. And that's exactly where we're headed. And it's contrived. It's by design.
So are the derivatives and the huge explosion in the derivatives, is that part of the design perhaps to bring it towards the collapse? And then how do they collapse it?
Well, yeah, the derivatives are just highly leveraged investment vehicles. I remember my dad when he was alive. I told my dad stay out of the stock market because, it's built on derivatives. And I told him, I explained to him, I said, here's how they work. They take the investments that are already out there, and they package them. and resell those investments on margin up to 100 to 1. And they'll put $1 down, and you can borrow $100 to buy an investment that's already been purchased. And it's all artificial. And, of course, he kind of laughed at me and so on and so forth. And then 60 Minutes, because I'm his kid, you know, and dads don't listen to their kids many times. And he was watching 60 Minutes. And 60 Minutes, this is back in the early 90s now, when we had the first derivatives blowout was in 87 when the stock market crashed here in the States. That's the first time we saw derivatives. They call them portfolio insurance in those days. And I was the head of a investment banking system at that particular point. I should say an investment banking company at that point in time. And that's when I saw the first – that's when the load opened my eyes to how this thing worked. And then in the early 90s, we had another round of derivatives that where the bubble popped. It's starting in Orange County. And Kidder Peabody went under, and Mutual Benefit Life. And I talk about those in the book. And so he called me, and he said, I was watching 60 Minutes, and – he said, those derivatives, he said, they're based on nothing. He said, they're nothing but air. And I said, well, imagine that, Dad. I think I told you that about a year ago. Yeah. And the bottom line is that derivatives are just highly leveraged investment vehicles that are designed to produce the maximum amount of profits by borrowing money and buying an investment to artificially drive it up so that you can sell later on and take the money. The only problem with that is that in a derivative, just like a futures contract, there's two sides to the derivative. There's the buy side and there's the sell side. And whoever buys that and sells high, and then it goes down, the person on the other side is the one who loses the money. And so just as much money that is made, there's as much money lost. And that's what happened this last time in 07, because all of those subprime loans and all of those various mortgages, they were all put into derivatives and then sold anytime 100 times to 1. So when people started wanting their money back, these countries and so on and so forth, what happened was there was no money to pay it back. See, that's the issue. There's so much more debt than there is money to pay the lender or the those who invested back. That when people start wanting their money, they just close the doors like Lehman Brothers did and said, we're not redeeming today. And it went down the tubes and almost collapsed the whole system.
So what about the Federal Reserve then? I think probably a lot of our listeners understand that it's not really the US government that owns it, that it's a privately owned bank. Is the Federal Reserve itself disposable in the long run?
Or? Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they all will be. But what will happen is all the central banks will come together and they will join forces in a one-world central bank, just like what they were talking about here in the UN report on the HDR, the Human Development Report. Is that there has to be some sort of financial crisis in which a revised IMF. See, we already have a world bank with a world currency called special drawing rights. And we've had that ever since World War II, when at the end of World War II, when the United Nations came out and developed the International Monetary Fund. But it's not going to work the way that it is. It has to be revised, just like it says. And that's where all the central banks throw in with each other into a single central bank. And people won't have a choice. They will, if they want to buy and sell and so on and so forth within the world system, which is where all the supply of goods and services and so on and so forth are, then they're going to have to join up to this system. And and cash will be eliminated because you can't control cash, so you've got to be in the system. The only monetary asset that's not somebody else's liability outside the system is the precious metals complex, gold and silver and even rare coins. And even precious stones can be used, but precious stones are not a monetary asset where gold and silver is.
So do you suggest that people put money into physical gold and silver? And what about the paper market for the gold and silver?
Well, the paper market's okay right now, but the only thing that's really going to survive the collapse of the debt-based paper system is going to be the physical, tangible, precious metals that you have in your hand. And then a lot of people will ask, well, if the system, you know, we have financial crisis, how do I spend my gold and silver? And that's really a very good question. And for that, you have to go back to how does the system work? Right now, with the financial system being up and running to where you can, you know, make deposits and withdraw money and use your credit card and your debit card and transfer funds and wire money internationally and all of that, as long as that system is up and running, as inflation goes up, and which means that the value of the dollar is going to go down or currency is going to go down, you can still trade in and prices will go up. It's not just gold and silver that goes up. It's prices go up as a whole. But if you have your money or your wealth in precious metals, then what happens is the value of that, the gold and silver, goes up along with prices, so that when you want to buy something, you just exchange your gold and silver for more of the currency so that you can go and buy the same amount of goods and services. If you leave it in the paper and the value of paper goes down, which drives prices higher, it takes more of your wealth in the form of the paper money to buy the same amount of goods and services. And so you lose the wealth through inflation. We call it the neutron bomb of economics. It keeps your numbers intact, but it destroys the purchasing power. Now, if the system goes down, that's what everybody wants to know. Well, nobody will be able to do any kind of financial transactions. So precious metals will be the money, barter will be the money of the day, and precious metals is the only monetary asset that will be out there tradable. Nobody's going to want paper dollars. It'll be over for paper dollars. Because whatever comes out the backside of that collapse, it will not be, you won't even recognize it. It will not be what we have today.
So precious metals, gold and silver, obviously will be always have some form of value because it's a monetary resource, always has been. It's, you know, scarce. In the previous interview, we talked very quickly about how a 666 system, you know, the beast system that arises out of this could possibly work. And you mentioned giving value to the Earth's resources, including people, which I presume, you know, gold and silver would be a considerable part of the Earth's resources. But how is this going to work? I mean, how could you value people and everything? I take it you think that's how the new system will eventually come out of this, something along those lines.
Well, yeah. In fact, in the book, I talk about one of the plans that this World Parliament has. There's a lot of different New World Order, One World Government, economic system groups out there that have different plans that they put forward. And they're all a little bit different, but for the most part, they're moving in the same direction. And in the World Parliament that's located right down here in Lakewood, Colorado, I mean, not even 20, 30 miles from me, there's this group that advocates for a one world government, a one world financial system, and so on and so forth. And in that, what they're saying is that the whole earth needs to be, and they put a a huge figure on it, and there was, with 6 billion people in the world, valued at $100,000 per person, and they put that on their balance sheet as working capital. And I thought that that was really interesting, considering the fact that each depositor, and it used to be deposits on the FDIC here in the United States, the Federal Deposit Insurance System. It used to say when it first came out, and I showed the different logos in the book, it used to be called, or it used to say that each deposit was insured for $100,000, but today when you look at it, they've upped it to 250, but it says each depositor is guaranteed up to $100,000. And so it takes the value off the deposit and puts it on the depositor. And so the bottom line is that they're putting a value, and I talk about that, how they're actually in the process right now of valuing the Earth's resources. And even I give an example in here on how these New World Order types, these environmentalists, are putting a value on the work that bees do to actually pollinate crops. It's unbelievable, and that goes back to the whole environmental issue and why they're trying to get control of the Earth's resources, and they're using the global climate change and global warming and so on and so forth as a tactic to get control of the Earth's resources.
So what about people then that have debt in that situation? If this goes up, will that debt be counted against them in the value, or how would that work, do you think?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That goes back to your original question, and that is, you know, what about people who have debt? Well, the scripture says there is an unchangeable law in the earth that was put there by God, and that is that the borrower is slave to the lender. And so when the financial system collapses and there's no resources to, quote, write it off. See, the thing about one world socialism, which is what the whole New World Order is about, New World Order is just, we talked about this last time, it's just a code word for one world socialism. That's what New World Order, really is saying. And that's where the government and it's the government and the financial and the political elite that grows up around it ultimately own and control the assets of everybody. And so what happens is that when that system collapses, everything will be thrown over and be owned by the lenders, including the people. I don't know if you remember when the Orange County collapsed, when the pension fund collapsed out there, because the pension fund manager was playing in the derivatives market and the market moved against him and Orange County went under. What was happening was that those who had lent money to Orange County that couldn't get their money back were actually petitioning the courts to go in and take the property of the citizens as in payment for Orange County collapsing. And when I saw that, I mean, the Lord just showed me, you know, he's continually showed me over the course of the years how this thing's going to unfold, is that when the whole world collapses on its debt, nobody's going to own anything. The lenders are going to own it.
And ultimately, so, that would be, I take it then, a very small number of people at the top of the pile will ultimately have control, because even those other people below them who are lenders, if they can't get their money, they're probably borrowed to somebody else. So so the whole thing will domino, and there'll just be a small select group at the top that won't be taken over.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And they, in the end, control the money. And so that goes back to, you know, money is the answer of all things. And whoever controls the money, in the end, controls the people and the nations.
So do you see this? Do you see this happening anytime soon, or is this a long way down the track? And then following on to that, how should people prepare?
Well, it has been happening. We've seen it, you know, on the scale like in 1987, that happened in the United States. We saw a transfer of wealth. Then in 1995, when Mexico collapsed, we saw transfers of wealth. Mexico didn't own its oil reserves. In order to get bailed out, they had to give their oil reserves up as collateral for the bailout. Now, they've since gotten that refinanced, but the nations, like Germany was one of the countries that came in and helped refinance Mexico. They have claim on a lot of Mexico's oil reserves. In fact, here's an interesting thing, and I talk about this in the book under debt for equity swaps chapter, is that in 1971, when Nixon was borrowing as much money as he was to finance the Vietnam War, and France, Charles de Gaulle, confronted Nixon and said, I don't believe, because Nixon was printing up bonds and selling them like crazy and borrowing money through the purchase by people, you know, selling bonds. And Charles de Gaulle said, I don't believe that you can pay those bonds off. And Nixon said, oh, yeah, no problem. You know, I'm not a crook and all that kind of stuff. And so France said, fine, we want our gold back. They actually sent ships to the harbor in New York, and they wanted their gold, and Nixon closed the gold window. Do you remember then what agency was started at that particular point in time at virtually the same time? Was the Environmental Protection Agency. See, the bottom line is this, is that if a country or anybody is going to borrow money, there has to be collateral. And since our money went off the gold standard, because up until then there was a gold standard. Gold was $35 an ounce. But after that, from 1971 to 1976, at the end of Jimmy Carter's reign, gold went from $35 an ounce to $196 an ounce. And the bottom line was that people understood the U.S. dollar didn't have the value that it did before, because there was no range. Everybody had to keep their currency within 1% of the price of gold in U.S. dollars. And when he closed the gold window and wouldn't redeem money to nations and stuff like that in gold anymore, gold went out on the free market. But he had to find collateral for the money that he was borrowing. And so he developed the Environmental Protection Agency that went out and started confiscating land and resources. And that's why there's been such a hoopla about not harvesting America's resources, is because it's collateral for our $20 trillion of debt now.
Ah, that's interesting. Yes, I hadn't actually thought of it quite like that. That's a bit of an eye-opener. So what about on an individual level then, though? If this is coming, should people be doing anything to prepare at this point? And if so,
well,
how?
Sure. The first thing we want to do is we want to get out of debt. Debt is going to be the millstone around people's necks, individuals, companies, nations, and so on and so forth. Because the borrower is slave to the lender. So I encourage people, the first thing we want to do is we want to get out of debt. You know, when we go into debt, we're just living beyond our means. The first thing you have to do is come back and live within your means. I know that I wasn't living within my means. I had a good job and I could make the payments and so on and so forth. And then in 87, when the stock market collapsed and the company that I worked for, you know, just took out all this middle management, even upper level management, because I was a president of one of three sister corporations, I found myself and I couldn't buy a job. I mean, I could not find a job to save my life, and so all my creditors came knocking on my door. And God let me experience what it was to be a slave to my lender. And that's when he opened my eyes to this. And so, and this last time in 07, here in the States now, I don't know what it was like down in New Zealand.
We actually got off pretty lightly here.
You did. Yeah. You did. Yeah. But here in the States, people had gone out and they had borrowed money on their homes after they bought their homes, and everybody else was buying homes, borrowing money and buying homes. The price of homes went up. There's even advertisements on the television now saying, let your home be your bank. Whereas price of real estate went up, people were taking money out in the form of equity loans. So the house that they bought for $250,000 went up to $500,000, and they were borrowing money all the way up out of it. But then when the market crashed and the houses went back down to $250,000, they owed $250,000 more on the house than what they could sell it for. And if they lost their job, they couldn't get out of it. And if they had to do a short sale to where, let's say, for example, they still owed $100,000 on it, then they had to either pay taxes on that $100,000 as income. In fact, before George Bush passed the legislation that let people off the hook for the difference, they actually were required to pay the $250,000 back, and that the banks and the lenders could garnish wages in order to get the money back. But they passed legislation that nixed that. So you just had to pay taxes on the increase. And so the bottom line was this, is that in the days ahead when that whole thing comes down, see if they start to garnish your wages because you can't pay back the debt that you owe, that's just a modern-day debtor's prison is all that it is. And that's where the whole world and everybody in it's going to end up going is into that great big debtor's prison called globalism.
Yeah, okay, that's very, very interesting. There's a lot in there. And one last question then I'd like to ask you is, you know, I'm sure that the majority of our listeners are probably Christians, and what advice would you give them at this point in terms of looking ahead, looking forward, going ahead? You know, what do you see God would be wanting people to do at this point in time?
Well, in Revelation 18, we see the judgment that he brings on the mystery of Babylon, and that's that demonic, we talked about that last time, that demonic blend of economics, politics, and religion that comes together under the guise of globalism, and that ultimately is what the Antichrist is going to end up ruling. But in Revelation 18:4, he says, come out of her, my people, so that you don't participate in her sin and receive of her plagues. And so what we need to do is, like I said, we need to get out of debt, but we also need to limit our exposure to that world system, especially from a financial standpoint, that's ultimately going to collapse. And that's where I prefer to use the precious metals. I can't tell people what to do with their money. I just know that precious metals is the only monetary asset that's going to survive the collapse of the debt-based currencies. And so come out by beginning to put some of your wealth, and I'm not saying put all of your wealth, but start as you see this thing start to go awry. Start to move out of the paper assets and getting into some of the precious metals. Right now is a great time to be watching and starting to liquidate some of those assets. Getting, you know, when you have a run up in the stock market, you know, my daddy always taught me to buy low and sell high. And so as you see the stock market going up, you know, just by faith, we start bringing that out and so on and so forth. We don't have to, and this, we have to go to the Lord. And that's the number one thing is we have to go back and begin to pray. There is no canned presentation or a canned approach for everybody, because everybody's in a little bit different situation. They have a different circumstance, different situation, different needs, and so on and so forth. And so, but this is the direction we need to start moving and coming out. And then when that new system arises, as long as we don't have to swear allegiance to anti-Messiah and take a chip in our hand or in our forehead, then we can go back into that system and still function. But remembering that your wealth, and we don't buy precious metals, we don't put our wealth in precious metals to make money. We just put it in there, a portion of it in there, to maintain our wealth, our purchasing power, outside of the collapsing debt-based paper system. That can be the only reason that we do that.
Wow, yeah, that's good advice. So can you give our listeners your website again?
You bet. It's ascensionministries.net, and that's ASCENSION, Ascension Ministries, and it's .net, because we are like we're an internet church here in the beautiful mountains of Colorado, just outside of Denver. Every Saturday at 1 o'clock Mountain Time in the USA, we have a Shabbat service. We've gone back to the Hebraic roots of Scripture, which is where you find out the truth about dishonest weights and measures. That has really helped us to understand God's whole word from Genesis to Revelation.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Norm. It's been fantastic talking to you today, and I'll definitely be keen to have you back on the show to talk about more of this before too long.
Well, anytime, because things are going to happen really fast, so I know we'll have a lot to talk about.
That'd be great. Thank you.
God bless you.
From time to time, I have people asking me, could I sell their products on our show? Or maybe I should use advertising to fund this A Minute to Midnight. And I have to say that right from the word go, I felt God saying no, he did not want me to run A Minute to Midnight that way, or want us to run A Minute to Midnight that way. And so we do run this entirely by donations, and we really appreciate the people that do donate and help us to keep this going like that. I suppose in a way, that's how God has got me getting us out of the system, out of the Babylonian system to some extent. And that's not to negate people that, you know, that do use advertising or other methods of doing things. But that's how I believe we were to run A Minute to Midnight. And you can find all of our shows at aminutetomidnight.com, and also articles that the team writes as well. And I do write and record and play all the music that's used on our shows, and you can find my music at rockshoresounds.com, and there's a link to that on the A Minute to Midnight website. So that is about it for today's show. Thank you for joining us, and we'll catch you in the next show.